Berno, and decided that the cause was lost. I rushed into the hut, seized my pack and belongings, and scrambled for the door. At the threshold, I dropped the pack and stooped to retrieve the clothes and other items that had spilled to the ground. In the act, I looked up to see some 20 or more women and children standing in a group and watching me. For an instant of perfect, wordless communication, I knew exactly what they were thinking. We stared across the open ground, and I heard their speaking minds. "Look at the big, strong foreigner, saving himself and running away from the fire, while our men run towards it." Ashamed, I stuffed my belongings into the pack and placed it at the feet of the woman, Radha, who'd been introduced as my neighbour. Then I turned and ran toward the fire. Slums are planless, organic disbursements. There's purpose in the narrow, twisting lanes, but no order. Within three or four turns, I was lost. I ran in a line of men who were moving toward the smoke and flames. Beside us, running, staggering, and bumping along the lane in the opposite direction, was a constant file of other people moving away from the fire. They were helping the elderly and herding the children. Some carried possessions, clothes, cooking pots, stoves, and cardboard boxes of documents. Many of them were injured, showing cuts, bloody wounds, and serious burns. The smell of burning plastic, fuel, clothes, hair, and flesh was acrid and unnerving. I turned a blind corner and another, until I was near enough to hear the roaring flames above the shouts and screams. Then a dazzlingly brilliant fireball burst through the gap between two huts. It was screaming. It was a woman, engulfed in flames. She ran straight at me, and we collided. My first impulse was to spring away, as I felt my hair, eyebrows, and eyelashes burn off in the contact with her. She stumbled and fell over backwards, still screaming and thrashing. I ripped the shirt from my back. Using it to protect my hands and face, I threw myself on her, smothering the flames with my skin and clothes. Others rushed forward and tended to her. I ran on toward the fire again. She was still alive when I left her, but a voice in my mind was declaring her dead. "She's dead. She's gone. She won't make it." The maw of the fire, when I did reach it, was terrifying. The flames roared to two or three times the height of the tallest hut and ranged across a semicircular front, arched away from us, that was 50 or more huts wide. Willful gusts of wind drove the arc forward in probing feints, flaring up suddenly on one side and then blazing towards us from a different direction. Behind it was the inferno, a cauldron of burning huts, explosions, and poisonous smoke. A man stood in the centre of the large arc of open space before the wall of flames, directing those who were fighting the fire as if he was a general ordering troops into battle. He was tall and lean, with silver-grey hair and a short, pointed silver-grey beard. He was dressed in a white shirt, white trousers, and sandals. There was a green scarf tied at his neck, and he held a short, brass-tipped wooden stick in his hand. His name was Kasim Ali Hussein, and that was my first glimpse of the head man in the slum. Kasim Ali's double tactic was to send beaters against the fire to slow it down, while other teams demolished the huts that stood in the fire's path and dragged away their contents to deprive the fire of fuel. That involved a staggered retreat, ceding land to the flames all the while, and then launching counterattacks wherever the fire seemed to weaken. Slowly turning his head and sweeping his gaze back and forth across the front of the fire, Kasim pointed with the brass-tipped stick and shouted commands. The headman turned his gaze in my direction. A sliver of surprise gleamed in the polished bronze of his eyes. His scrutiny took in the blackened shirt in my hand. Without a word, he lifted his stick to point toward the flames. It was a relief and an honour to obey him. I trotted forward and joined a team of beaters. I was very glad to find Johnny Cigar in the same team.
"Okay," he shouted.
It was both encouragement and inquiry.
"Okay,"
I shouted back. "We need more water."
"There is no more water,"
he called back, gasping as the smoke eddied around us.
"The tank is empty. Trucks will fill it up tomorrow. The water that people are using here is their ration.
I discovered later that every household, my own included, was rationed to 2 or 3 buckets of water per day for all cooking, drinking and washing needs. The slum dwellers were trying to put the fire out with their drinking water. Every bucket thrown, and there were many, forced one more household to spend a thirsty night, waiting for the morning delivery of water in city council trucks.
I hate these fucking fires,
Johnny cursed, slamming downward with a wet sack to emphasize his words.
Come on, you fuck! You want to kill me? Come on! We will beat you! We will beat you!
A sudden quirk of the fire sent a burst of orange flame toward us. The man beside me fell backward, screaming and clutching at his burned face. Kasim Ali directed a rescue team to help him away. I seized his discarded sack and fell into line beside Johnny, slamming at the flames with one hand and shielding my face with the other. We glanced over our shoulders, often, to receive directions from Kasim Ali Hussein. We couldn't hope to put the fire out with our wet rags. Our role was to gain time for the demolition teams scrambling to remove endangered huts. It was heartbreaking work. They were saving the slum by destroying their own houses. And to gain time for those wrecking teams, Kasim sent us left and right in desperate chess moves, starving the fire and slowly winning ground. When one squalling downdraft of wind swept black and brown smoke into our clearing, we lost sight of Kasim Ali Hussein completely. I wasn't the only man who thought to pull back in retreat. Then, through the smoke and dust, we saw his green scarf held aloft and fluttering in the breeze. He stood his ground and I glimpsed his calm face, summing up the status of the struggle and calculating his next move. The green scarf rippled above his head like a banner. The wind changed again, and we hurled ourselves to the task once more, inspired with new courage. The heart of the man with the green scarf was in me, and in all of us. In the end, when we'd made our last sweep through the scorched lanes and charred lumps of houses, looking for survivors and counting the dead, we stood together in a mournful assembly to hear the tally. It was known that 12 persons were dead, 6 of them elderly men and women, and 4 of them children. More than 100 were injured, with burns and cuts. Many of them were serious wounds. About 600 houses were lost, 1/10 of the slum. Johnny Segar was translating the figures for me. I was listening to him with my head close to his, but watching Kasim Ali's face as he read from his hastily prepared list of the dead and injured. When I turned to look at Johnny, I found that he was crying. Prabhakar pushed through the crowd to join us, just as Johnny told me that Raju was one of those who died in the fire. Raju, with the sad, honest, friendly face. The man who'd invited me to live in the slum. Dead.
Damn lucky, Prabhakar summed up cheerfully when Kasim Ali had called the tally.
His round face was so blackened with soot that his eyes and teeth seemed almost supernaturally bright.
Last year, in the last big fire, a full 1/3 of the Jhopadpatti was burning up. 1 house from every 3 houses. More than 2,000 houses gone. Kalas! More than 40 people dying also. 40! It's too many, Lin, let me tell you. This year is a very lucky fire. And our houses are safe also. Bhagwan have blessings on our brother, Raju.
Shouts from the edge of the somber crowd drew our attention, and we turned to see one of the search teams pushing their way through to Kasim Ali. A woman from the team was carrying a baby they'd rescued from the smouldering rubble. Prabhakar translated the excited shout and chatter for me. 3 adjoining huts had collapsed in the blaze, falling on a family. In one of those inexplicable quirks of the fire's action, the parents of the child had suffocated and died. But the child, a baby girl, had survived. Her face and body were untouched, but her legs were severely burned. Something had fallen across them at mid-thigh, and they were black, split, and cracked. She was screaming in pain and terror.
Tell them to come with us, I shouted to Prabhakar. Lead me back to my hut and tell them to follow us. I've got medicine and bandages.
Prabhakar had seen the large and impressive first aid kit many times. He knew it included bandages, salves and creams, disinfectant solutions, swabs, probes, and an array of surgical instruments. Grasping my meaning at once, he shouted a message to Kasim Ali and the others. I heard the words medicine and doctor repeated several times. Then he grasped my sleeve and dragged me with him, jogging back to the hut. With the kit open on the ground in front of my hut, I applied local anesthetic cream to the baby's legs in a thick smear. It began to work almost at once. The baby settled down to a quiet whimper and cuddled within her rescuer's arms.
"Doctor, doctor, doctor," people said, all around me.
Kasim Ali called for lamps to be brought as the sun set on the Arabian Sea, and the long Bombay evening finally succumbed to warm, star-filled night. By the yellow flickering lamplight, we tended to the wounded slum dwellers, using my first aid kit as the basis of our little open-air clinic. Johnny Cigar and Prabhakar worked with me as translators and nurses. The most common injuries were burns, cuts, and deep gashes, but a great many people were also affected by smoke inhalation. Kasim Ali Hussein watched us for a short while, and then left to supervise the erection of emergency shelters, the rationing of remaining water supplies, the preparation of food, and the dozen other tasks that would fill the night to morning and beyond. A cup of tea appeared beside me. My neighbour, Radha, had made it and brought it to me. It was the first thing I ate or drank in the slum, and it was the best chai I ever tasted in my life. An hour later, she forced her husband and two other young men to drag me from the injured people to eat a meal of roti bread, rice, and bhaji. The curried vegetables were deliciously spiced, and I cleaned the plate with the last bite of roti. And again, hours later, after midnight, it was Radha's husband, Jitendra, who pulled at my arm and drew me into my hut, where a hand-crocheted blanket had been spread out on the bare earth. Unresisting, I collapsed on the blanket for my first night of sleep in the slum. 7 hours later, hours that passed as if they were minutes, I woke to see Prabhakar's face hovering in the air. I blinked and squinted and realized that he was squatting on his haunches, with his elbows on his knees and his face cupped in his hands. Johnny Cigar was squatting beside him on his left, and Jitendra was on his right.
"Good morning, Lin Baba," he said cheerfully, when my eyes settled on his. "Your snorings is a fabulous thing. So loud, like having a bullock in this hut, Johnny said so."
Johnny nodded his agreement, and Jitendra wagged his head from side to side.
"Old Sarabhai is having a first-class cure for snorings," Prabhakar informed me. "She can take one very sharp piece of bamboo, about the same as long as my finger, and push it up inside of your nose. After that, no more snoring. Bas kalas."
I sat up on the blanket and stretched the stiffness from my back and shoulders. My face and eyes were still gritty from the fire, and I could feel that the smoke had stiffened in my hair. Lances of morning light stabbed through holes in the walls of the hut.
"What are you doing, Prabhu?" I asked irritably. "How long have you been watching me sleeping?"
"Not so very long, Lin. Only for the 30 minutes or so."
"It's not polite, you know," I grumbled. "It's not nice to watch people when they're sleeping."
"I'm sorry, Lin," he said quietly. "In this India, we can see everybody sleeping at some times. And we say that the face, when it is in sleeping, is the friend of the world."
"Your face is so kind when you are sleeping, Lin," Johnny Cigar added. "I was very surprised."
"I can't begin to tell you what this means to me, guys. Can I expect to find you in the hut every morning when I wake up?"
"Well, if you really, really want, Lin," Prabhakar offered, jumping to his feet. "But this morning we only came to tell you that your patients are ready."
"My patients?"
"Yes, come and see."
They stood and opened the door of the hut. Sunlight splintered into my burning eyes. I blinked and stepped through, following the men into the brilliant bayside morning to see a line of people squatting on the ground outside my hut. There were 30 or more of them forming a queue along the length of the lane to the first turn.
"Doctor, doctor,"
people murmured and whispered when I emerged from the hut.
"Come on,"
Prabhakar urged, tugging at my arm.
"Come on where?"
"First to toilet," he replied happily. "You must make a motion, isn't it? I will show you how we make emotions into the sea on the long cement jetty. That is where the young men and boys make their motions every morning into the oceans. Motions into the oceans, isn't it? You just be squatting down with your buttocks pointing on the oceans. Then you wash your good self with a shower and you have it a happy breakfast. Then you can easily fix up all your patients, no problem.
We walked along the length of the queue. They were young and old, men and women. Their faces were cut, bruised and swollen. Their hands were blackened, blistered and bloody. There were arms in slings and legs in splints. And at the first turn, I saw to my horror that the queue extended into the next lane and was longer, much longer. "We've got to do something," I mumbled. "They're all waiting."
"No problem waiting, Lin," Prabhakar replied airily. "The people are waiting more than 1 hour already. If you are not with us, they would still be waiting, but waiting for nothing only. Waiting for nothing, that is what killed the heart of a man, isn't it? Now the people are waiting for something. Waiting for you, they are. And you are a really something, Lin Shantaram, if you don't mind them saying it to your smoky face and sticking up hairs. But first, you must make it motions, and then washing, and then breakfast. And we have to get going. Some young fellows are waiting down there on the jetty and wanting to see you make your motions."
"They what?"
"Oh, yes, they are fascinating for you. You are like a movie hero for them. They are dying to see how you will make your motions. And then, after all these things, you will return and fix the patients. Like a really hero, isn't it so?"
And in that way was my role in the slum created. "If fate doesn't make you laugh," Carla said in one of my first conversations with her, "then you just don't get the joke." As a teenager, I'd trained in first aid treatment. The formal course of study had covered cuts, burns, sprains, breaks, and a wide range of diagnostic and emergency procedures. Later, I'd earned my nickname, Doc, by using my training in CPR to pull junkies out of overdoses and save their lives. There were hundreds of people who only knew me as Doc. Many months before that morning in the slum, my friends in New Zealand had given me the first aid kit as a going-away present. I was sure those threads, the training, the nickname, the first aid kit, the work as unofficial doctor in the slum, were all connected in some way that was more than accident or coincidence. And it had to be me. Another man, with my first aid training, or better trained, wouldn't have been forced by crime and a prison break to live in the slum. Another criminal, ready to live there with the poor, wouldn't have had my training. I couldn't make sense of the connection on that first morning. I didn't get the joke, and fate didn't make me laugh. But I knew there was something, some meaning, some purpose, leading me to that place and that job at exactly that time. And the force of it was strong enough to bind me to the work, when every intuition tried to warn me away. So I worked into the day. One by one, the people gave me their names and their smiles, and one by one I did my best to treat their wounds. At some point during the morning, someone put a new kerosene stove in my hut. Someone else provided a metal box for rat-proof storage of food. A stool found its way into my hut, and a water pot, the ubiquitous mutka, and a set of saucepans, and a few pieces of cutlery. As evening throbbed in a scarlet arch of sky, we sat in a group near my hut to eat and talk. Sadness lingered in the busy lanes, and memories of those who'd died receded and returned like waves moving on the great ocean of the heart. Yet carried on that sadness, a part of sorrowing itself, was the determination of those who'd endured. The scorched earth had been cleared and cleaned, and many of the huts were already rebuilt. Hopes rose with every humble home that was restored. I looked at Prabhakar, laughing and joking as he ate, and I thought of our visit with Carla to the standing Babas. One moment from that evening, one heartbeat's length of time, as the crazed man had charged at us with a sword, was stretched in my memory. At the precise instant when I took that step backwards and raised my hands in a boxing stance to fight, Prabhakar took a step to the side and stood in front of Kala. He wasn't in love with her, and he wasn't a fighter. Yet his first instinct was to step sideways and protect Kala by shielding her with his body, while my first thought was to step back and fight. If the mad swordsman hadn't been tripped, if he'd reached us, I would have been the one to fight him. And probably I would have saved us. I'd fought men with fists, knives and clubs before, and I'd won. But even then, even if it had gone that far, Prabhakar would have been the real hero, for the bravery of that little instinctive sideways step. I'd grown to like Prabhakar. I'd learned to admire his unshakable optimism. I'd come to depend on the comforting warmth his great smile provided. And I'd enjoyed his company, day and night, through the months in the city and the village. But in that minute, on my second night in the slum, as I watched him laughing with Jitendra, Johnny Cigar, and his other friends, I began to love him. The food was good, and there was enough for all. Music played on a radio somewhere. It was the fine, almost unbearably sweet soprano and happy, boasting tenor of a duet from an Indian movie. The people talked, nourishing one another with their smiles and conversation. And sometime during the course of that love song, somewhere in the landscape of the slum dwellers' reassurances, somehow through the fact of our survival, their world enfolded my life within its dreams, as gently and completely as a swollen tide closes over a stone that stands upon its shore. Part 2. Chapter 9. I escaped from prison in broad daylight, as they say, at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, over the front wall and between two gun towers. The plan was intricate and meticulously executed, up to a point, but the escape really succeeded because it was daring and desperate. The bottom line for us, once we started, was that the plan had to succeed. If it failed, the guards in the punishment unit were quite capable of kicking us to death. There were two of us. My friend was a wild, big-hearted 25-year-old, serving a life sentence for murder. We tried to convince other men to escape with us. We asked 8 of the toughest men we knew, all of them serving 10 straight years or more for crimes of violence. One by one, they found an excuse not to join in the attempt. I didn't blame them. My friend and I were young first offenders with no criminal history. We were serving big years, but we had no reputation in the prison system. And the escape we'd planned was the kind that people call heroic if it succeeds, and insane if it fails. In the end, we were alone. We took advantage of extensive renovations that were being carried out on the Internal Security Force building, a 2-story office and interrogation block near the main entrance gate at the front wall. We were working as maintenance gardeners. The guards who pulled shifts in the area saw us every day. When we went to work there, on the day of the escape, they watched us for a while, as usual, and then looked away. The security force building was empty. The renovation workers were at lunch. In the few long seconds of the little eclipse created by the guards' boredom and their familiarity with us, we were invisible, and we made our move. Cutting our way through the chain-link fence that closed off the renovation site, we broke open a door to the deserted building and made our way upstairs. The interior was hollowed out by the renovation. Unplastered walls showed the skeleton structure of uprights and load-bearing beams. The bare wooden steps on the stairway were white with dust and littered with fragments of brick and plaster. There was a manhole in the ceiling on the top floor. Standing on my friend's strong shoulders, I punched out the wooden trapdoor in the manhole and climbed through. I had an extension cord with me, wrapped around my body under my coveralls. I uncoiled it and pulled it free, fixed one end to a roof beam, and passed the other down to my friend. He used it to climb up into the roof space with me. The roof stretched out in zigzag waves. We scrambled towards the narrowing pinch of space where the roof met the front wall of the prison. I chose a spot on one of the troughs to cut our way through, hoping that the peaks on either side would conceal the hole from the gun towers. It was dark everywhere in the roof space, but in that narrow wedge near the wall, it was blacker than a guard's baton. With a cigarette lighter for a lantern, we worked to cut our way through the double thickness of hardwood that separated us from the tin on the outside of the roof. A long screwdriver, a chisel, and a pair of tin snips were our only tools. After 15 minutes of hacking, scraping, and stabbing at the wood, we'd cleared a little space about the size of a man's eye. Waving the flame of the hot cigarette lighter back and forth, we could see the glint of the metal roof beyond the small hole. But the wood was too hard and too thick. With the tools we had, it would take us hours to make a man-sized hole. We didn't have hours. We had 30 minutes, we guessed, or maybe a little more, before the guards did a routine check of the area. In that time, we had to get through the wood, cut a hole in the tin, climb out on the roof, use our power extension cord as a rope, and climb down to freedom. The clock was ticking on us. We were trapped in the roof of the security building, and any minute we knew, the guards might notice the cut fence, see the broken door, and find the smashed manhole. Any minute, they could come up through the manhole into that black, sweating cave and find us.
"We've got to go back," my friend whispered. "We'll never get through the wood. We've got to go back and pretend it never happened."
"We can't go back," I said flatly, although the thought had screamed through my mind as well. "They'll find all the broken stuff, the fence we cut, and they'll know it was us. We're the only ones allowed in the area. If we go back, we're in the slot for a year." The slot was prison slang for the punishment unit. In those years, that unit, in that prison, was one of the most inhumane in the country. It was a place of random, brutal beatings. A failed attempt to escape through the roof of the security force building, their building, the head office for the punishment unit guards, would ensure that the beatings were less random and more brutal.
"Well, what the fuck are we gonna do?"
my friend demanded, shouting with everything but his voice. Sweat dripped from his face, and his hands were so wet with fear that he couldn't hold the cigarette lighter.
"I think there's two possibilities," I declared.
"What are they?"
"First, we could use that ladder, the one that's chained to the wall downstairs. We could go down again, break the chain off the ladder, tie the extension cord to the top of it, slam it up against the wall, climb up, and throw down the cord on the other side. Then we can slide down to the street."
"That's it?"
"That's the first plan."
"But they'll see us,"
my friend protested.
"Yeah." "And they'll start shooting at us."
"Yeah."
"They'll shoot us. You said that." "Well, fuck me," he hissed. "I think it bears repeating. It's a fucking salient point, don't you think?"
"I figure that one of us will get through, maybe, and one of us will get shot. That's 50-50. We considered the odds in silence for a while.
"Well, I hate that plan,"
my friend shuddered.
"So do I. What's the second plan?"
"Did you notice that buzzsaw on the ground floor as we came up here?"
"Yeah."
"If we bring it up here, we could use the buzzsaw to cut through the wood. Then we can use the tin snips to cut through the tin. After that, it's back to the original plan."
"But they'll hear the thing,"
my friend whispered fiercely.
"I can hear them talking on the fucking telephone. We're that close. If we drag the saw up here and fire it up, it'll sound like a fucking helicopter."
"I know. But I think they'll just figure it's the workers doing more work."
"But the workers aren't here."
"No, but the shift at the gate is changing. There's new guards coming on duty. It's a big chance to take, but I think if we do it, they'll just hear the noise, as usual, and think it's the workers. They've been listening to drills and hammers and buzzsaws for weeks. And there's no way they could imagine that it's us doing it. They'd never figure that Crims would be crazy enough to use a power saw right next to the main gate. I think it's our best shot."
"I hate to be Mr. Fucking Negative here," he objected.
But there's no electricity in this building. They shut it off for the renovating. The only power point is outside. The extension cord is long enough to reach down there, I think, but the power is outside the building.
I know, I know. One of us will have to go down, creep out the door we busted open, and plug the extension cord into the outside power outlet. It's the only way.
Who goes down there?
I'll do it, I said. I tried to sound confident and strong, but there are some lies that the body just won't believe, and the words came out as a squeak. I scrambled over to the manhole. My legs were stiff with dread and tension cramp. I slid down the extension cord and crept down the stairway to the ground floor, playing the cord out all the way. It reached to the door with plenty to spare. The buzzsaw was resting near the door. I tied the extension cord around the handle of the saw and ran back up the stairs. My friend pulled the saw up into the manhole and then passed the cord back to me. Once more, I crept down to the door. With my body pressed flat against a wall, I breathed hard and tried to find the courage to open the door. At last, with a heart-wrenching rush of adrenaline, I pushed the door aside and stepped out into the open to plug the cord into the socket. The guards, armed with pistols, were talking among themselves, not 20 meters from the door. If one of them had been facing my way, it would have been over. I glanced up to see that they were looking in every direction but mine. They were talking and walking about in the gate area, and laughing at a joke someone had just cracked. No one saw me. I slipped back inside the building, crawled like a wolf on all fours up the stairs, and dragged myself up the cord to the manhole. In the dark corner near the trough in the zigzag roof space, my friend lit the cigarette lighter. I saw that he'd connected the power saw to the cord. He was ready to make the cut. I took the lighter and held it for him. Without a second of hesitation, he hoisted the heavy saw and clicked it to life. The machine screamed like the whine of a jet engine on a runway. My friend looked at me, and a huge grin tore his mouth open. His teeth were clenched in the smile, and his eyes were glittering with the reflected fire. Then he drove the saw into the thick wood. With four swift, ear-splitting cuts, he made a perfect hole that revealed a square of gleaming tin. We waited in the silence that followed, our ears ringing with diminishing echoes and our hearts thumping at our chest. After a moment, we heard a telephone ring close by at the main gate, and we thought we were finished. Then someone answered the phone. It was one of the gate guards. We heard him laugh and talk on in a relaxed conversational tone. It was okay. We were safe. They'd heard the power saw, of course. But just as I'd hoped, they'd dismissed it as noise made by the workmen. Heartened, I punched a hole in the tin with the screwdriver. Sunlight from the free sky above shot in on us. I widened the hole and then used the tin snips to cut a panel of tin around three sides. Pushing with two sets of hands, we shoved the flap of tin outwards, and I poked my head through the hole. I saw that we had indeed cut our way into one of the troughs of the roof. The deepest part of that V-shaped trench was a blind spot. If we lay down in that narrow defile, we couldn't see the tower guards and they couldn't see us. We had one job left to do. The power cord was still plugged into the outlet downstairs and outside the building. We needed the cord. It was our rope. We needed it to climb down the outside of the prison wall to the street. One of us had to go down the stairs, push out through the door in full view of the guards in the adjacent gate area, unplug the power cord, and then climb back up into the roof again. I looked at my friend, his sweating face clear in the bright light bathing us from the hole we'd cut in the roof. And I knew it had to be me. Downstairs, with my back against the inside wall, next to the door, I paused again and tried to will the strength into my arms and legs for the move out into the open. I was breathing so hard that I felt dizzy and nauseous. My heart, like a trapped bird, hurled itself against the cage of my chest. After a few long moments, I knew I couldn't do it. Everything, from judicious caution to superstitious terror, screamed at me not to go out there again. And I couldn't. I had to cut the cord. There was no other way. I took the chisel from the side pocket of my coveralls. It was very sharp, even after the work we'd done with it in trying to penetrate the wooden barrier in the roof. I placed it against the trailing power cord, where it entered under the door. I raised my hand to strike. The thought occurred to me that if I blew out the power by cutting through the cord, it could sound an alarm, and perhaps send a guard into the building to investigate. It didn't matter. I didn't have any choice. I knew I couldn't go out into the open again. I slammed my hand down hard onto the chisel. It cut through the cord and embedded itself in the wooden floor. I swept the snipped ends of the cord away from the metal chisel and waited for the sound of an alarm or the tumble of voices to approach from the gate area. There was nothing. Nothing. I was safe. I grabbed the loose end of the power cord and rushed back upstairs and into the roof space. At the new manhole we'd cut in the roof, we secured the cord to a heavy wooden bearer beam. Then my friend started out through the hole. When he was halfway onto the tin roof, he got stuck. For a few moments he couldn't move upward and he couldn't move back. He began to thrash wildly, straining with all his strength, but it was hopeless. He was stuck fast. It was dark again in the roof space, with his body blocking the hole we'd made. I scrabbled around with my hands in the dust, between the roof joists, and found the cigarette lighter. When I struck it, I saw at once what had trapped him. It was his tobacco pouch, a thick leather wallet that he'd made for himself in one of the hobby groups. Telling him to hold still, I used the chisel to tear a flap in the pocket at the back of his coveralls. When I ripped the pocket away, the tobacco pouch fell free into my hands, and my friend went up through the hole and onto the roof. I followed him up to the tin roof. Wriggling like worms in the gutter of the trough, we moved forward to the castellated front wall of the prison. We knelt to look over the wall. We were visible then for a few seconds, but the tower guards weren't looking our way. That part of the prison was a psychological blind spot. The tower guards ignored it because they didn't believe that anyone would be crazy enough to attempt a daylight escape over the front wall. Risking a quick, frantic glimpse at the street below, we saw that there was a queue of vehicles outside the prison. They were delivery men, waiting to enter through the main gate. Because each vehicle was searched throughout and checked with mirrors beneath, the queue made slow progress. My friend and I hunkered down in the trough to consider our options. "That's a mess down there."
"I say we go now," he said.
"We have to wait," I countered.
"Fuck it, just throw the cord over and let's go."
"No," I whispered. "There's too many people down there."
"So what?"
"One of them will play hero for sure."
"Fuck him. Let him play hero. We'll just go over the top of him."
"There's too many of them."
"Fuck 'em all. We'll go straight through 'em. They won't know what hit 'em. It's us or them, mate."
"No," I said finally. "We have to wait. We have to go over when there's no one down there. We have to wait." And we did wait. For a 20-minute eternity. And I wriggled forward again and again to look over the wall, risking exposure every time. Then, at last, I looked down to the street and saw that it was completely empty in both directions. I gave my friend the signal. He scrambled forward over the wall and down out of sight. I crept forward to look, expecting to see him climbing down the cord, but he was already on the street. I saw him disappear into a narrow lane across the street from the prison. And I was still inside, on the roof. I clambered over the bluestone parapet and took hold of the cord. Standing with my legs against the wall and the cord in both hands, my back to the street, I looked at the gun tower on my left. The guard was talking into a telephone and gesturing with his free hand. He had an automatic rifle slung over his shoulder. I looked to the other tower. The guard there, also armed with a rifle, was calling down to another guard inside the prison in the gate area. He was smiling and relaxed. I was invisible. I was standing on the front wall of the toughest maximum security prison in the state, and I was invisible. I pushed off with my legs and started the descent, but my hands slipped, the fear, the sweat, and I lost the cord. I fell. It was a very high wall. I knew it was a killing fall to the ground below. In an agony of terror and desperation, I grabbed at the cord and seized it. My hands were the brakes that slowed my fall. I felt the skin tear away from my palms and fingers. I felt it singe and burn. And slower, but still hard enough to hurt, I slammed into the ground, stood, and staggered across the road. I was free. I looked back at the prison once. The cord was still dangling over the wall. The guards were still talking in their towers. A car drifted past on the street, the driver drumming his fingers on the steering wheel in time to a song. I turned my back. I walked on through the lane into a hunted life that cost me everything I'd ever loved. When I committed the armed robberies, I put fear into people. From that time, even as I did the crimes, and on through prison and life on the run, fate put fear into me. The nights were steeped in it, and sometimes I felt as if the blood and the breath in my body were clotted with fright. The fear I'd put into others became 10 terrors, 50, 1,000, filling the loneliest hours of every night with dread. By day, in those early Bombay months, when the world worked and worried around me, I wedged my life into a busy thickness of duties, needs, and small pleasures. But at night, when the sleeping slum dreamed, the horror crept across my skin. My heart backed away into a black cave of memory. And I walked most nights, while the city slept. I walked, and I forced myself not to look over my shoulder at the gun towers and the dangling power cord on the high wall that wasn't there. The nights, at least, were quiet. At midnight, every night in those years, the cops imposed a curfew on Bombay. 12:30, police jeeps gathered in the main streets of the central city and began the enforced closure of restaurants, bars, stores, and even the tiny pavement shops that sold cigarettes and pan. The beggars, junkies, and hookers who weren't already at home or hiding were chased from the footpaths. Steel shutters came down over the shop windows. White calico cloths were thrown over the tables in all the markets and bazaars. Quiet and emptiness descended. In the whirl and crush of people and purposes in Bombay's daylight scramble, it was impossible to imagine those deserted silences. But each and every night was the same, soundless, beautiful, and threatening. Bombay became a haunted house. For 2 or 3 hours after midnight, in an operation known as the Roundup, squads of plainclothes cops patrolled the vacant streets in search of criminals, junkies, suspects, and homeless unemployed men. More than half the people in the city were homeless, of course, and many of them lived, ate, and slept on the streets. The sleepers were everywhere, stretched out on the footpaths with only a thin blanket and a cotton sheet to keep out the damp of night. Single people, families, and whole communities who'd escaped some drought, flood, or famine slept on the stone paths and in doorways, huddled together in bundled necessity. It was technically illegal to sleep on the streets in Bombay. The cops enforced that regulation, but they were as pragmatic about it as they were about enforcing the laws against prostitution on the street of 10,000 whores. A certain discrimination was required, and in fact, the list of those they wouldn't arrest for the crime of homelessness was quite long. Sadhus and all other religious devotees, for example, were exempted. Elderly people, amputees, the sick, or the injured didn't find much sympathy and were sometimes forced to move on to another street, but they weren't arrested. lunatics, eccentrics, and itinerant entertainers such as musicians, acrobats, jugglers, actors, and snake charmers were occasionally roughed up, but they were invariably excluded from the roundup. Families, particularly those with young children, usually received no more than a stern warning not to remain longer than a few nights in a given area. Any man who could prove he had a job, however menial, by displaying the business card or written address of his employer, was spared. Single men who were clean and respectful and could demonstrate some level of education could usually talk their way out of an arrest, even if they weren't employed anywhere. And of course, anyone who could pay bakshish was safe. That left the very poor, homeless, unemployed, uneducated, single young men as the high-risk group in the midnight roundup. With no money to pay their way out of the police net and not enough education to talk their way out, scores of those young men were arrested throughout the city every night. Some of them were arrested because they fitted descriptions of wanted men. Some were found to have drugs or stolen goods in their possession. Some were well known, and the cops arrested them routinely on suspicion. Many, however, were simply dirty and poor and stricken with a sullen helplessness. The city didn't have the funds to provide thousands of pairs of metal handcuffs, and even if the money were found, the cops probably wouldn't have burdened themselves with heavy chains. Instead, they carried lengths of rough twine made from hemp and coconut fibres, and used it to tie the arrested men one to the other by the right hand. The thin rope was enough to hold the men, because the victims of nightly roundups were mostly too weak, undernourished, and spiritually defeated to run. They submitted meekly, silently. When between a dozen and 20 men had been arrested and tied into the human chain, the 6 or 8 cops in the roundup squad marched them back to holding cells. For their part, the cops were fairer than I'd expected them to be, and undeniably brave. They were armed only with the thin bamboo cane known as the lathi. They carried no clubs, gas, or guns. They had no walkie-talkies, so they couldn't call for backup if they ran into trouble on the patrols. There were no vehicles to spare for the roundup, so the squads walked the many kilometres of their beat. And although they struck out often with the lathi, savage or even serious beatings were rare. Much less frequent than police beatings in the modern Western city where I'd grown up. Nevertheless, the roundup did mean days, weeks, or even months of confinement for the young men, in prisons that were as bad as any in Asia. And the caravans of roped, arrested men that shambled throughout the city after midnight were more melancholy and forlorn than most funeral processions. In my late-night walks around the city, I was invariably alone when the roundup was done. My rich friends feared the poor. My poor friends feared the cops. Most foreigners feared everybody and kept to their hotels. The streets were mine as I searched their cool silences. On one of those night walks, about 3 months after the fire, I found myself on the sea wall at Marine Drive. The broad footpath beside the sea wall was bare and clean. A 6-lane road separated the seaside path from a horizon-wide, incurving crescent of affluence. Fine homes, expensive apartments, consular offices, first-class restaurants, and hotels that looked out over the black and heaving sea. There were very few cars on the drive that night, only one every 15 or 20 minutes, travelling slowly. Few lights shone in any of the rooms across the street behind me. A cool wind carried the clean salt air in irascible gusts. It was quiet. The sea was louder than the city. Some of my friends from the slum worried about me walking alone on the streets at night. "Don't walk at night," they said. "The night is no safety in Bombay." But it wasn't the city that I feared. I felt safe on the streets. Strange and troubled as my life was, the city enfolded it within the millions of others, as if it belonged there, no less than any other. And the work I was doing enhanced that sense of belonging. I gave myself assiduously to the role of slum doctor. I found books on diagnostic medicine and studied them by lamplight in my hut. I accumulated a modest cache of medicines, salves and bandages, buying them from local chemists with money I earned in black market deals with tourists. And I stayed on there, in those squalid acres, even after I'd made enough money to leave. I stayed on in the cramped little hut when I could have moved to a comfortable apartment. I allowed my life to be swept up in the broiling, dancing struggle of their 25,000 lives. I bound myself to Prabhakar and Johnny Cigar and Kasim Ali Hussein. And although I tried not to think of Carla, my love put claws in the sky. I kissed the wind. I spoke her name when I was alone. On the sea wall, I felt the cool breeze wash across the skin of my face and chest, like water poured from a clay matka. There was no sound but my own breath in the wind and the crash of deep water on the rocks, 3 meters below the wall. The waves, reaching up in splash and spindrift, pulled at me. Let go. Let go. Get it over with. Just fall down and die. So easy. It wasn't the loudest voice in my mind, but it came from one of the deepest sources. The shame that smothered my self-esteem. The shamed know that voice. You let everyone down. You don't deserve to live. The world would be better off without you. And for all that I tried to belong, to heal myself with the work in the clinic, to save myself with the fool notion of being in love with Carla, the truth was that I was alone in that shame and lost. The sea surged and shoved at the rocks below. One push and it would all be over. I could feel the fall, the crash as my body struck the rocks, the cold slipperiness of drowning death. So easy. A hand touched my shoulder. The grip was soft and gentle, but firm enough to hold me there. I turned quickly in shocked surprise. There was a tall young man standing behind me. His hand remained on my shoulder as if to brace me there, as if he'd read my thoughts a few moments before.
"Your name is Mr. Lin, I believe," he said quietly. "I don't know if you can remember me. My name is Abdullah. We met at the den of the Standing Babas."
"Yes, yes," I stammered. "You helped us, helped me. I remember you well. You left, you disappeared, before I got to thank you properly." He smiled easily and took away his hand to run it through his thick black hair.
"No need for thanks. You will be doing the same for me in your country, isn't it? Come, there is someone who wants to meet you."
He gestured to a car that was parked at the curb 10 meters away. It had drawn up behind me and the motor was still running, but somehow I'd failed to hear it. It was an ambassador, India's modest version of a luxury car. There were 2 men inside, a driver and 1 passenger in the back. Abdullah opened the rear door, and I stooped to look inside. A man in his middle to late 60s sat there, his face half illuminated by the streetlights. It was a lean, strong, intelligent face, with a long, thin nose and high cheekbones. I was struck and held at once by the eyes, an amber brilliance of amusement and compassion and something else. Ruthlessness, perhaps. Or love. His hair and beard were close-cropped and white-grey.
"You are Mr. Lin?" he said.
His voice was deep, resonant, and supremely confident.
"I am pleased to meet you. Yes, very pleased. I have heard something good about you. It is always a delight to hear good things, and even more pleasurable when it concerns foreigners here in our Bombay. Perhaps you have heard of me also. My name is Abdel Kader Khan."
Sure, I'd heard of him. Everyone in Bombay had heard of him. His name appeared in the newspapers every other week. People spoke about him in the bazaars and nightclubs and slums. He was admired and feared by the rich. He was respected and mythologized by the poor. His discourses on theology and ethics, held in the courtyard of the Nabila Mosque in Dongri, were famous throughout the city and drew many scholars and students from every faith. No less famous were his friendships with artists, businessmen and politicians. He was also one of the lords of Bombay's mafia, one of the founders of the council system that had divided Bombay into fiefdoms ruled by separate councils of mafia dons. The system was a good one, people said, and popular, because it had brought order and relative peace to the city's underworld after a decade of bloody power struggles. He was a powerful, dangerous, brilliant man.
"Yes, sir," I answered,
shocked that I'd inadvertently used the word sir. I loathed the word. In the punishment unit, we were beaten whenever we failed to address the guards as sir.
"I know your name, of course.
The people call you Kader Bai." The word Bai, at the end of his name, meant elder brother. It was a term of respectful endearment. He smiled and nodded his head slowly when I said it. Kader Bai. The driver adjusted his mirror and fixed me in it, staring expressionlessly. There were fresh jasmine flowers hanging in garlands from the mirror, and the perfume was intoxicating, almost dizzying after the fresh wind from the sea. As I leaned into the doorway of the car, I became acutely conscious of myself and my situation, my stooping posture, the wrinkles in my frown as I lifted my face to see his eyes, the rim of guttering at the edge of the car's roof under my fingertips, and a sticker pasted to the dashboard that read, "God bless, I am driving this car." There was no one else on the street. No cars passed. It was silent, but for the idling engine of the car and the muffled churning of the shuffling waves.
"You are the doctor in the Kolaba Hutments, Mr. Lin. I heard of it at once when you went to live there. It is unusual, a foreigner living in the Hutments. This belongs to me, you understand. The land where those huts stand, it belongs to me. You have pleased me by working there."
I was stunned into silence. The slum where I lived, known as the Jopadpati, or the Hutments, half a square kilometre, with 25,000 men, women and children, belonged to him. I'd lived there for months, and I'd heard Kader Bai's name mentioned many times, but no one had ever said that he owned the place. It can't be, I heard myself thinking. How can any one man own such a place and all its lives? I'm not a doctor, Kader Bai, I managed to tell him.
"Perhaps that is why you are having such success in treating the sick, Mr. Lin. Doctors will not go into the Hutments willingly. We can compel men not to be bad, but we cannot compel them to be good, don't you find? My young friend, Abdullah, recognized you just now as we passed you sitting on the wall. I turned the car to come back here for you. Come, sit inside the car with me. I will take you somewhere."
I hesitated. "Please, don't trouble yourself.
No trouble, Mr. Lin. Come and sit. Our driver is my very good friend, Nazir."
I stepped into the car. Abdullah closed the door behind me, and then sat in the front next to the driver, who adjusted the mirror to find and fix me in it again. The car didn't move off.
"Chilum bono,"
Kader Bai said to Abdullah. "Make a chilum." Abdullah produced one of the funnel-shaped pipes from his jacket pocket, placed it on the seat beside him, and set about mulling together a mix of hashish and tobacco. He pressed a ball, known as a goli, of hashish, onto the end of a matchstick, and burned it with another match. The smell of the charas coiled into the perfume of the jasmine flowers. The engine of the car was still idling slowly and quietly. No one spoke. In 3 minutes the chillum was prepared and offered to Kader Bai for the first dum, or puff. He smoked and passed the pipe to me.